December 3, 2020, the day of my brain surgery. The view of my bald head in the hospital bathroom mirror is harsh. I shower with soap brought from home and wipe myself down as instructed with 7 large antiseptic body cleansing washcloths before getting into the surgical gown. This one's blue cotton. There are compression socks to guard against deep vein thrombosis. A man arrives to transport me to a pre-operation waiting room. We exchange no words or eye contact. I'm a piece of cargo, and I'm disempowered by the fact that I don't have my phone with me. That portable world so intrinsic in these times to one's cultural identity, from which you can contact a loved one, occupy yourself with a book or a game or an article from the New Yorker or a weather app, and be the person you are. Instead, I'm a hairless head on top of a flimsy cotton gown and long compression socks. If I held my hands in front of me and turned them upside down, I could remind myself of why the hell I'm here by watching them shake. As I wait to be taken to the operating theatre, I channel my inner journalist. I'm on a news assignment for which I've already gathered some key facts. Sydney's St Vincent's Hospital was the first in Australia and the Southern Hemisphere to deliver the therapy I'm about to have. The $6.5 million technology was installed in its radiology department, with tremor patients being treated from late 2018. About 80 other people at this hospital have been wheeled down this same path over this past couple of years. Sydney nun, Sister Carmel Smith, was the first. Minutes after the procedure, having endured medication-resistant tremulous hands all her adult life, Sister Smith drank from a glass of water which she held with a now steady grasp and exclaimed, "Alleluia." I've sometimes felt like I was the only one with this weird set of tics, this multifaceted condition that research makes clear is increasingly being diagnosed and understood. But I'm far from it. Tremors of the body affect more than 800,000 Australians, and an estimated 70,000 have dystonia, the movement disorder for which I'm here to have my brain zapped. The condition has myriad manifestations, and everyone with it lives within a body that doesn't work as it should. For me, it means being hampered when performing simple tasks like drinking and eating, because my hands shake when I lift a cup or a knife or a fork. At other times, my head shakes and my neck twists painfully to one side. In social situations, I mask these difficulties to avoid the attention that they attract. This can make me seem secretive, as if I have a hidden agenda. Above the seat that I'm directed to is a television with Nine's Today Show blaring. I hate morning television. It grates on my jumpy post-sleep nervous system. A newspaper man I once worked for is being interviewed about something in Melbourne. His hair, which used to be black or dark brown, is now white. He was once a comparatively sensitive news editor. Now he's a shock jock. Minutes feel like hours before I'm led to a bed and two nurses wheel me into the MRI suite. One is speaking loudly, piercing my hard-won calm. She seems edgy, careless, not focused on her work. I wonder if she's hungover. I'm usually hypersensitive to noise and disruption. Today was hardly going to be an exception. It's the early 1960s in suburban Melbourne. I'm 4, maybe just 5 years old. Still delivered by horse and cart, our milk arrives in glass bottles with aluminium peel-off caps, the cream gathered at the top. The milkman leaves it at the front gate near the letterbox. I've taken it upon myself this day to collect the bottle. I haven't been asked or authorised, and know I'm not quite old enough. And there's a nervous thrill to this which makes me want to walk fast and get it done so I can show that I'm at a helping age. I'm mid-flight to the front steps when the bottle slips from my hand and smashes, glass shards and crystals poking through the liquid wastage, dribbling across the garden path. Tearful howls of failure are soon joined by cries of parental horror and fear that I've cut myself. Unlike my older sister, who is sensible and competent, I'm clumsy, prone to dropping things, a risk taker too. They never know what I'll do next. Away from supervision when we play in our suburbs, streets, cuttings, lanes and parks, it falls to my sister Kristen to get me home without incident. This is not easy. Mine is an early childhood where I jump off a garage roof and fall on my face, walk barefoot down a disused road onto broken glass, ride a stricken friend's three-wheeler at breakneck speed down a steep hill until I crash onto a road below, steal crayons and coloured paper from the kindergarten with my friend Anthony, cut and bloody my hands when I break a razor blade I've found in the dirt into pieces so that it can't be used for a bad purpose, like a child murder I've heard about on the news. Fill a discarded bath with cold water in Melbourne's winter, then submerge myself fully clothed, accept money from the much older boy next door to let him touch me. I'm 3.5 years old for that. And my friend Anthony and I have a stone-throwing fight with some kids on the other side of the railway line to us. One of my stones hits the girl in the side of the head and I worry she'll die. I check the newspaper the next day to make sure she hasn't. These episodes piled together make me sound like a serious, troubled child. But despite them all, I'm regarded by my elders as thoughtful, curious, eager to learn, loving, smart, funny, precocious and industrious. A girl with all these characteristics doesn't quite fit the stereotype for her gender in the mid-1960s. I'm different and by turns anxious and confident. I also worry a lot about death, and perhaps because of this, I want to grab at life.